Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Andrew Constance makes his first appearance at the Sydney Institute, talking on matters relating to the New South Wales economy. Mr. Constance has been the MP for Bega since 2003. He held a number of shadow ministerial positions when the coalition was in opposition, and a number of ministerial positions under the O'Farrell government. But of course, in recent times, Andrew Constance is the treasurer in the Baird government, and is going to speak for us tonight on the topic of transforming New South Wales in the context of federation reform. Mr. Constance, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, good evening, everybody, and thank you, particularly to Gerard and Anne, for having me here this evening to speak at what is without doubt one of the most important institutes in the country. As you now know, given Gerard's introduction, I also happen to be the member for Bega. But that, in my role, means that I'm also a part-timer to Sydney. And if you reflect on this week in particular, I mean, it has been one tremendous week for our state, as we see the motorcades of international dignitaries swarming around our city in the week following the G20. The city humming with construction, cranes in every corner. It feels like our great city is thriving whilst the world is watching. Tonight I'm going to talk to you about the exciting task ahead of this government, rebuilding New South Wales in the context of federation reform. I'm going to briefly share with you this government's vision to transform our great state, but I'll spend most of my time on why we need to grasp with both hands the historic opportunity to concurrently review the federation and tax system in Australia. The next 5 years will be an exciting time in New South Wales. The Baird government will transform our state. Our $20 billion Rebuilding New South Wales program we'll see new productive infrastructure, much needed and long overdue infrastructure, delivered by releasing the capital locked up in the state's electricity network businesses. And why do we need to rebuild our state? Well, at the heart of the problem is that congestion is crippling New South Wales. It's costing our state, on average, around $5 billion per annum in lost economic growth. People in Sydney are spending 185 hours a year stuck in traffic on the M4, M5, M1, or on roads like Victoria, Parramatta, the Spit, or the Princes Highway, when they could be at home with their families and or friends, or at work boosting our state's productivity. We have a unique opportunity to unleash our global city's economic potential by delivering world-class transport and motor networks. And in country New South Wales, we must unlock our freight pinch points and build new roads, dams and water pipelines. We need to get our produce and minerals to our ports with ease and at low cost so our farmers can capitalise on our proximity to Asian markets and respond to one of the greatest challenges of the 21st century, food security. In fact, Deloitte's Economics has assessed our $20 billion plan and have established that by investing in this way, gross state product will benefit to the tune of $30 billion per annum, with the additional creation of 150,000 jobs. If the government receives the mandate in March to lease the poles and wires, we have identified the following strategic priorities for funding. Sydney Rapid Transit, reducing congestion across the rail network by way of a Second Harbour rail crossing and the Western Extension, providing rapid transit to more commuters in the northwest, Bankstown and inner west. the Sydney Roads Renewal Program, including the WestConnex. And in the recent state budget, we announced scoping work in relation to the M6, Northern Beaches and the M9. A regional roads fund for roads and bridges in regional areas, eliminating the need for diversions, delays and backtracking. A regional water fund for water security and quality in regional areas. A schools and hospitals building fund to deliver new educational and public healthcare facilities. And one that excites me, a sport and cultural infrastructure fund with new and upgraded sporting facilities and a much needed injection of capital into cultural infrastructure. As we look down the barrel at the exciting future ahead of us, it's hard to believe that when we took office 3.5 short years ago, on every conceivable measure, our state was last. Sydney was declared full and the state lost its mojo. Standard & Poor's recently noted, when taking us off negative outlook, the state has managed its finances incredibly well. We've reduced growth in expenditure to below that of revenue growth, and we've used the flexibility of our balance sheet to begin to clear the $30 billion infrastructure backlog inherited from the former government. This government has taken the necessary actions, and often hard decisions, to improve the long-term sustainability of the state's finances. Recently, New South Wales officially returned to being number one under the ComSec State of the States report. Now is the time to embrace the opportunities ahead of us. And if the Baird government is re-elected in March 2015, we will be seeking to deliver the government's plan to rebuild New South Wales. But it's also a great time for New South Wales to lead the states as the nation debates the Federation and taxation white papers. With an eye to the future, the Commonwealth Government's promised mature debate on federation reform presents an enormous opportunity to transform the functions and operations of state governments. The three most significant areas of opportunity that I think this process can address are firstly to remove the duplication across the tiers of government, align the incentives for good policy and tax outcomes, and thirdly, a greater focus on individual outcomes across all levels of government. Firstly, the opportunity this process provides to remove duplication across government. The duplication of functions between Canberra and the states places an unnecessary burden on taxpayers. There are health and education departments in Canberra that don't run a single school or hospital or have anything to do with a pupil or a patient. Fortunately, the Commonwealth recognises the issue of duplication and say that their white paper will, I quote, consider ways to reduce and end as far as possible the waste, duplication and second guessing between different levels of government and make interacting with government simpler for citizens. Through this process, we can also place under the microscope the ability of the states to deliver microeconomic reform. After all, it's the state's collective productivity that drives the nation's productivity. This government has already started the process in the areas of vocational education and training, energy reforms and planning. Secondly, federation reform presents a significant opportunity to better align incentives for good policy and tax outcomes. A sensible conversation on the federation must also address the issue of tax, which is why I was glad to see the Prime Minister announce he would be reviewing them both concurrently. My overriding principle when it comes to tax is that Australians should pay less tax into a fairer system. To ultimately achieve transformative change, we must recognise the significant challenges for the states, which, in the current system, are constrained by narrow caste and highly inefficient tax bases. Recently, on being given the honour to serve as the state's treasurer, I was handed the task of bringing down a budget within 6 weeks. While it was a well-received budget, it highlighted the broken federation and also demonstrated the structural deficiencies and risks to the long-term sustainability of state finances. Of course, we welcomed with open arms major infrastructure spending from the Commonwealth. Projects such as Western Sydney Roads around Badgerys Creek Airport, WestConnex and the Pacific Highway featured prominently. Yet the decision to sever a number of national partnerships, particularly in health, that will force the states to either find health savings, return to Canberra to plead for a new deal, or show leadership through the tax and federation reform. Later this decade, the Commonwealth starts to significantly withdraw its support from healthcare funding. In 2018, the federal government's funding for our health system represents just short of 30%. In 2050, it will fall to just above 10%. Federal financial relations in Australia are marked by a mismatch between revenue-raising capacities and service provision responsibilities. The Commonwealth government collects around 75% of combined federal and state revenue and around 84% of combined tax revenue, including the GST. But it's responsible for only about 58% of total government spending, including defence and welfare payments. The states, on the other hand, collect around 25% of all federal and state government revenue, but are responsible for around 42% of combined spending, including schools, hospitals, and other essential services. On this basis, vertical fiscal imbalance was estimated at around $85 billion in 2012-13. That's more than the entire budget for New South Wales. In 2014-15, the Commonwealth Government is expected to distribute around $88 billion to the states, with a majority in GST revenue payments. GST revenue is distributed among the states using horizontal fiscal equalisation, which rewards states who do not get their house in order. And those with a long memory will know that the history of revenue-raising spending responsibilities of the national and state governments goes back a hell of a long way. There's the provision in the Constitution that provides that with the handover of customs duties to the Commonwealth as part of the Federation, the states would get the excess of duties collected over the expenditure needs of the Commonwealth. Modern state treasurers will be unsurprised to learn that it was only a handful of years before the expected excess was zero, and the states lost all income from this source. Then there was the temporary takeover of income tax by the Commonwealth for war purposes that never came back to the states. In our modern, technologically advanced society, conventions must change, and the realignment of responsibilities between the tiers of government must take place. Tax reform must be considered in a new age in which disruptive technologies will erode the nation's tax base. With a highly centralised tax system that exists in Australia, the states are left with narrowly based and inefficient transaction taxes, such as stamp duty. Not only are we at the whim of volatile property and labour markets, but likewise, we are exposed to these very changing and disruptive technologies. Tax reform should also recognise the current lack of alignment of incentives for states to undertake microeconomic reform. New South Wales needs a professional government led by leaders who know what they're doing to contribute to this important discussion on tax and federation reform. Thirdly, I think federation reform can help drive a far greater focus on individual outcomes. With clearer accountabilities across levels of government, it is my view that this will drive a greater focus on individual outcomes and in the same cases get governments out of what they shouldn't be doing in the first place. An example of government policy focused on individual outcomes is the National Disability Insurance Scheme. And I would like to recognise Patrick Maher from National Disability Services here this evening. It's an issue that is close to my heart given my former role as a Minister for Disability Services in New South Wales. The National Disability Insurance Scheme is a real and transformative reform which should stand as an example that if we broaden our perspective, anything is possible. The NDIS and the agreement between the Commonwealth and the states to implement it is more than just about money and which level of government should run the National Disability Insurance Scheme. The agreement provides much needed funding, this can't be denied. But more important is that we aren't swapping a state government service for a Commonwealth service. We are playing the role that only government can, which is to provide the money and the organisation. But by placing the expenditure in the hands of people with disabilities, their carers and their families, we are going to get better outcomes across our community. There is no doubt the National Disability Insurance Scheme is a human rights issue. With the NDIS, the only question left is whether we should, in the Federation White Paper process, find a way for just one level of government to pay the whole bill. One view could be that shared accountability is diminished accountability. Or alternatively, will people with disability feel more comfortable in having both Commonwealth and state government sharing responsibility on the basis that neither can deny responsibility and both need to care about the outcomes? Government is still the only body with the economic and organisational capacity to procure many services. But this doesn't mean government doing the service provision is the best answer. With clearer accountabilities, we can also build better technological systems across the tiers of government that will transform the interface between community and government. A great example of this is Service New South Wales, which is the New South Wales government's one-stop shop for government transactions. Service New South Wales takes a customer-centred approach to government services, where people used to go to the RTA for driver's license applications and birth, deaths and marriages for birth certificate applications. Now they can do more than 800 state government transactions in one place with Service New South Wales. Since its launch in 2013, Service New South Wales has served more than 7 million customers through their digital service, 24/7 phone service, and 20 service centres across New South Wales. And today we opened our first digital store in North Sydney. One question I have is, as part of the Federation reform process, is it possible for Commonwealth services to be made available through the New South Wales service, platform? And herein lies the challenges in terms of the Federation and the technological advance. There is no reason, with the platform that we have built at a state level, that both local government and the Commonwealth government cannot access that platform and in doing so provide a complete customer experience for our citizens in terms of their interaction with government. And at the end of the day, this exercise must be ensuring that we can transform the face of government through the use of such technologies, in particular smartphones, to be able to reduce the back-end costs of government and at the same time deliver tremendous outcomes for the people of this state. Any conversation on Federation reform and taxes must consider the impact on those whom the government exists to serve. That is, of course, the people of New South Wales and Australia. Before I conclude, I just want to take a moment to reflect on what I think success looks like when it comes to Federation reform. From my perspective as Treasurer, there are three key issues facing our community that I think Federation reform can help us solve for. Future healthcare funding, poor regulation across key sectors, and funding and incentives for infrastructure development. If, at a minimum, Federation reform can help us address these issues, then I'd call that progress. To conclude, we're entering a new exciting era in this state. We have an ambitious infrastructure agenda, technology is advancing faster than many of us can conceive, and the way we fit into the Federation is finally subject to a rigorous review. Thank you for being here this evening.
Many thanks to the Treasurer for his address tonight. A couple of questions and discussion. Before we do so, I should say thanks to King and Wood Mallesons for the use of this fine facility this evening with this view over much of Sydney. Treasurer, when you introduced yourself, you mentioned, as I'd mentioned, you were the member for Bega, and you described yourself as an occasional visitor to Sydney. So when you're looking at your infrastructure agenda, which is quite substantial as you've outlined it tonight, what's in it for the good people of Bega? What's in it for rural, non-Sydney, New South Wales?
Well, it's a matter that's very dear to my heart because if I was to look at the infrastructure deficit in regional New South Wales, it's quite profound. And for too long, particularly when it comes to dealing with the challenges in terms of getting our minerals and produce to port and to our far-flung markets. There has been an enormous frustration on the part of primary industries in terms of achieving those outcomes. That said, also the vital infrastructure to provide the health outcomes and the education outcomes for rural and regional communities has also posed a significant challenge. There's, without doubt, I mean, previous governments have been Sydney-centric focus, but this government currently has some $13 billion under investment in infrastructure across the regions. There isn't a major regional centre in this state which is not undergoing some form of major hospital redevelopment or new hospital build on a greenfield site. There's some 80 projects currently underway in that regard. And of course, in an area such as mine, where we've laid witness to the sea change population, and in some cases it's reversing because people can't gain access to the relevant health care that they're seeking in country areas, with people returning back to our major metropolitan centres to gain access to some of those specialised services. It has meant that governments need to be smarter a bit about their infrastructure spend. We've had a real focus on the Princes and Pacific Highways, and certainly in terms of this year's state budget, there's a $5.8 billion allocation towards the ongoing duplication of the Pacific Highway. In terms of the Princes Highway, we're now going to see over $1 billion invested into a highway, which for a country member like myself, is one which has posed significant challenges. I can remember one period back around the 2003-2004 period in which there was a six-month period where around 20 locals lost their lives on a road which was built to World War II standards, not to modern-day standards. So there's a profound social impact in terms of not having the right road configurations, but at the same time it's affecting our commerce. So I'm quite excited about the Poles and Wires transaction, the lease of Transgrid, Ausgrid and Endeavour Energy. We have indicated that some $6 billion off the back of that transaction is going to be invested in to regional New South Wales. But my role through that is to ensure that if we are going to take the proceeds from the networks, they must be invested back into productive infrastructure. So we're not going to go and fund, you know, a local country showground. We're going to be taking those proceeds, ensuring the discipline in terms of having a business cost ratio of 1+ to every dollar that is expended, and we're going to make sure that we're investing in the productive infrastructure to deliver real economic benefits. To have Deloitte syndicate a $30 billion per annum improvement in the state's economic prospects off the back of a $20 billion infrastructure investment makes enormous sense to proceed down this path.
There's a question down there.
Treasurer, thank you for coming this afternoon. Mining in New South Wales, some of the limitations on the some of the mining in New South Wales, will they be lifted in the near future?
Question about the limitations on mining in parts of New South Wales.
We need a strong mining sector in this state. There is absolutely no doubt in terms of addressing our challenges around gas that we have to have the right balance. And at the same time, given what we're seeing in terms of the commodity markets, we are seeing enormous challenges flowing through to the mining sector at this time, in particular our coal industry. At the same time, as a result of the former government, we've seen a rigorous planning framework which has been put in place, which has been deliberately set at an independent level through the Planning Assessment Commission, at arm's length from politicians, with the responsibility of making decisions. We, at the moment, I think it's fair to say, we need to be looking more closely at how that process is working in terms of some of the frameworks that exist in terms of decision making. But you know, we need to ensure that we are continuing to work alongside the mining sector to deliver the outcomes, and at the same time giving a greater certainty in terms of, in particular, you know, our gas issue, because we do have a supply problem, and it is going to affect our manufacturing base in a very stark way fairly quickly. We released the gas plan only a week or so ago. We are very conscious that certainly where we've come from, where in terms of the exploration licences, they were just issued for $1,000 to anyone who was willing to put their hand up, and we ended up with a large proportion of New South Wales subjected to the exploration licences, that on coming to government, we needed to put in place the right regulatory structure to allow that industry to work itself up and start to give greater confidence to the community in terms of coal seam gas. And, you know, I think by putting in place 2 kilometre exclusion zones around communities, we worked through a strategic lands use policy to try and drive greater understanding as to where the sector could start to develop. And that coupled at the same time with a ban on BTEX chemicals and also making sure that the industry had confidence in what the government was doing has been key to this. So we have implemented that gas plan now, and I feel confident that we will start to see a greater confidence and understanding in terms of the gas, coal seam gas industry, given the very obvious need that we have in terms of our manufacturing and industry base into the future.
Don.
Treasurer, my name's Don Murray. As a member for Bega, there's been a lot of discussion over the last couple of days about agriculture. It's all of a sudden become a fashionable topic for Australia. You'd have a lot of experience about what it actually takes to get development to happen in regional Australia. What's your sense about how soon and how significant we'll see the impact of the free trade agreements that have been entered into over the last couple of months actually start impacting your region?
Well, ironically, I had dinner with the chair of Bega Cheese last night, so I won't reflect our entire discussion, but, you know, there's an air of confidence. You know, there's no reason why agribusiness in this nation shouldn't flourish in a way that we've never seen before, particularly the advent of the middle classes, particularly in China and India, and the demands for our produce. I can tell this great story. I'll just finish on dairy and say that from an organisation such as Bega Cheese's perspective, the future is incredibly bright. There's an enormous interest in investing in milk powder-based products, particularly given the demand that we're going to see throughout Asia as a result. One of the greatest stories I can tell coming from Bega is that, you know, I think the advent of the free trade agreements is fantastic, but there's been some individual farmers out there doing amazing things off their own back for a very long period of time. And I never forget a guy by the name of Andy Baker who just jumped off a plane from Tokyo. Andrew Baker is an oyster farmer in Pambula Lake, one of the most southernmost lakes in this state. And he'd been to Tokyo. And I struck him in the Rex Lounge at Sydney Airport, and he very happily produced out of his bag a menu from a Tokyo restaurant which had oysters listed and, of course, Pambula Lake in brackets, Pambula Lake, New South Wales, Australia. Well, I said to him, well, mate, you know, he said it's been incredible hard work over 10 years to crack the market. But I said, how much are you selling them for? He said, oh, $10 an oyster. So it's a great way to have happy oyster farmers. But, I mean, the point here is the government in New South Wales, I think, dropped the ball in terms of our trade relations. And we're now starting to open up trade offices. Very pleasingly, for a small industry like the oyster industry, we've now facilitated their attendance at trade shows in Hong Kong. And for these farmers, they're now going to be exporting world-class produce to those markets at levels they've never seen before. So I'm very excited about the opportunities that lay ahead. The free trade agreement opens up enormous scope for agribusiness. And I guess, again, the only observation and challenge that I'd state there is that one of the great challenges for our farming community is to continue to attract young farmers to either stay on the family property or for, you know, new entrants to enter agribusiness and take up the enormous opportunities that lay ahead.
Question there? Yes.
Yes, thanks, Treasurer. You mentioned vertical fiscal imbalance, which is basically that the state doesn't raise as much revenue as the Commonwealth does. What's your preference or the government's preference for addressing that? I mean, there are a range of options which have been mooted, like, you know, increasing the GST or the state making better use of its own existing bases, or another option is for the states to get a particular share of a Commonwealth's existing base. Do you or the government have a particular view on which of those should or should not be looked at?
Yeah, my predecessor, who's of course now Premier, argued very strongly that New South Wales should get a greater share of the income tax base. I mean, we've seen, obviously, in terms of the GST being a growth tax, some funny things happened in recent years off the back of the global financial crisis and changing consumer patterns. And at the same time, obviously, you know, back in the 1970s, with payroll tax, again, supposed to be a growth tax. And it's this constant whim of, from a state's perspective, being susceptible to the volatility in labour and property markets. So I think one of the exciting things about the tax reform process is that we will be able to put under the microscope the way in which the state tax system does interface with the Commonwealth. You know, I think certainly in terms of dealing with those challenges, I would hate to again see another tax white paper produced without getting results. And I think this is the excitement in this process now, is that we're actually going to have a mature debate about the Federation and the roles and responsibilities concurrently. Because if we can get that right, then I think it flows. And, you know, I know certainly around the time of the Commonwealth budget, I mean, Joe Hockey indicated very happy for the states to run schools and hospitals. Well, my message back to Joe is, why run federal departments of health and education? That's one key point. Again, coming from Bega, I've got an enormous fishing community. They struggle with the red tape of having to deal with both a state and federal bureaucracy when it comes to fisheries management, and they keep making the point to me that the fish don't know the difference. So, you know, we've got to look very closely at that. I do think that you touch on GST. Again, we're not getting up a capita share in terms of New South Wales. The states that do the heavy lifting are quite often the ones that are at disadvantage. Ultimately, as I indicated, I think all Australians should be paying less tax but into a fairer system. We should approach this debate with that principle very much in mind.
Question there.
Good evening, Treasurer. My name is Leonard Young. I was wondering whether you could give some of your views as to some concerns in the public. Like foreigners are buying a lot of farms. What would you say to those?
Question about the concern in the community that foreigners are buying up too much of the farm.
Look, I think, we have a Foreign Investment Review Board that oversees this process. Yes, you quite often hear these concerns. From a state perspective at the moment, we wouldn't have the strong economy that we do in New South Wales if it wasn't for a very strong property market. So, from my perspective, I have no interest in tampering with stamp duties and the like. I want to continue to see a property market remain strong, and in doing so, I have to say most analysts thought that the property boom might have ended by now, and of course it's continuing on. From a state treasurer's perspective, it's very healthy to see stamp duty revenues coming in at the level that they are, but you know, that's offset by, and someone touching on mining before, we've seen a significant drop in mining royalties. So payroll tax receipts are soft, mining royalties have plummeted through the floor. So there is a degree of offset in terms of the tax take from a state perspective. But, we have to have a very strong air of confidence. I mean, we need to be a place of foreign investment. 2 weeks into the job, I got to finalise the transaction around the Port of Newcastle. Now, the very pleasing thing about that transaction was that you had China Merchants Company in partnership with Hastings Funds Management, 9 million Australian superannuants, in a winning bid to take on a 98-year lease in the management of the Port of Newcastle, the largest coal export port in the world. And, you know, when that occurred, I thought there'd be some degree of political blowback in relation to foreign investment. Not a peep. We're a far more sophisticated country and place than where we have been previously. And I am very confident, particularly as we've seen, the interest in New South Wales, to have the opportunity this week with all the world leaders looking at this state in particular, and you only need to look at the happy snaps of the Premier and the number of people he's seen this week, that there is a very real interest in where we're headed as a state. I don't want to risk that. And whilst it's tempting to see some debates and pockets of debates across our community in this regard, no one should ever underestimate the strength of foreign investment and the confidence that we must lay to continue that investment into, without doubt, one of the greatest states in the country.
There's a question down there. Yes.
Hi, Treasurer. Thank you very much. Look, I just wanted to ask on the topic of foreign investment, what is your view on investors from other countries and in prime agricultural land? You also mentioned technical security in your speech, so yeah, I just want to know what your view on that is.
What about the issue of foreign investment in prime agricultural land in view of the necessity for food security?
Well, again, I mean, this is why we have the Foreign Investment Review Board. I think ultimately for a farmer who might want to move to retirement and what have you, you know, there are some quite often decisions that they might make in a personal capacity in terms of who might be the future owner of their property. I think ultimately, yes, Australians want to continue to see, you know, strong Australian ownership of our agricultural lands. But by the same token, this is why we have the FIRB. And ultimately, if governments at a national level decide to review those processes from time to time, that's not a bad thing. Ultimately, I see food security as the greatest challenge of this century. It is certainly in terms of the demands that we're going to see, as I indicated, in terms of the advent of the middle classes, particularly in China. There is enormous scope and opportunity for this country to look very closely at its water infrastructure, look very closely at its agricultural productivity, and everybody can benefit from that. Earlier today, some of my ministerial colleagues and I was in attendance had an audience with the Chinese Premier. He raised Australian wine. And he did make the point that French wine's too expensive. So, you know, here we go. You know, this is the very nature and change in consumption behaviour that we're going to see throughout the Asian region. And we need to be ready. We need to be looking at those opportunities. And this is, again, one of the great disciplines in terms of the infrastructure spend is how do you place it, where do you place it, and particularly around water infrastructure, how can you deliver those outcomes? So, yes, I'm conscious of the debate around foreign ownership, but for me the greater challenge is how can we make our agricultural lands far more productive to benefit everybody, and that therein lies, I think, the key challenge ahead.
Thank you, Treasurer. I was wondering if you might like to comment on one of the principles of our federation, which is that it has been a competition between the states, and in both policy sense, tax sense, to attract investment and so forth, and whether you think that is a good thing or a bad thing, and whether it should be one of the fundamental principles of the review.
Question about competition between the states, good thing or a bad thing?
Well,
in relation to investment.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's number one, you know, we've been doing it right. It's an interesting challenge at the moment. Queensland have just announced that they're going to lease their electricity businesses. They're going to 100%. We indicated otherwise. But we are, of course, doing the scoping work. So I would say that competition is good, but in terms of that particular transaction, there's the risks there in terms of the debt and equity markets to be able to soak up these assets if this is not worked through. So, I'm certainly, very conscious when you see the nation's treasurer offer up $5 billion of incentive payments, and it's first in, first served in terms of recycling the capital out of your existing assets, and Canberra willing to step in with that incentive payment, that it does generate healthy competition. And I think that plays an important role in terms of microeconomic reform and productivity. It's a key driver in that sense. And to that end, it's healthy for everybody that we do have that competitive tension. And where possible, obviously, the Canberra has looked at ways in which they can incentivise the process. That, to me, should also be on the agenda in terms of federation reform. That competitive tension across the federation, again, I think we as a state have an opportunity to lead that, and in doing so, making sure that we get it right, and making sure that those incentives are right from Canberra, because I dare say I don't think $5 billion is enough to ultimately solicit the outcomes which I think Joe Hockey is looking for in terms of productivity uplift and certainly in terms of the infrastructure backlogs that states and our dear friends at local government level are trying to deal with.
When dinner parties start talking about property prices in Sydney, it's good news, and at the moment we've got a bit of a boom on, but increasingly Sydney's a very expensive city for average earners to live and work in. And yet, it's very hard to find jobs in many cases in the regional centres. So what's the plan for making housing affordability better in places like Sydney, which is, you've got to travel a long way if you want to bring up a small family, or making it better for people to find jobs in regional areas?
Question about housing affordability in Sydney or the ability to find jobs in regional areas.
Anyone reading the Herald today will see some interesting views in relation to infill development, particularly the west of the city. But I think traditionally some governments in the past have thought, oh, well, we can offer up grants and incentive payments, and ultimately, in some circumstances, former governments drove up the price of housing off the back of having available some of those first home owner grants applying across all properties as opposed to trying to drive new housing construction. If you consider back in 2009, the former state government only approved 16,000 homes. In the last 12 months, we're now at 52,000. That we are doing everything we can to address this problem through supply. Through our budget, we had to tackle the issues around the fact that our expenditure growth was way out of kilter and out of control, and we've reined that in so that we're living within our means. But one of the outcomes of that is that we've been able to direct stimulus towards housing acceleration and making sure that we're able to build the local government infrastructure to start to bring online more housing supply. So when you look at, obviously, the northwest and southwest growth corridors in Sydney, they are extraordinary, and we've got some very significant investments going in terms of infrastructure to service those, in essence, satellite cities. I do think that we are going to see, and I don't think we'll see a bubble burst. I think the population growth into New South Wales is strong. There is enormous demand, and you know, I guess the key challenge is particularly for first homeowners who are trying to get into the market. That said, we do need to also look at our infill opportunities. That's why the Bays precinct to the west of the city is incredibly exciting in terms of new residential commercial benefits that will be derived. We do need to look at other areas across the city, particularly to the southeast of the city, down through through to Maroubra. I think there's enormous opportunities that lie ahead there. Of course, we will see, as a result of the advent of WestConnex, which is a 33-kilometre motorway network that we're starting to build, which links, in essence, the M4 to the M5, that it will also transform precincts such as Parramatta Road as well. So we will continue to do everything to incentivise and drive supply to address that. Or alternatively, you can come to a shire like mine in the Yirrabadalla where property prices are going backwards because of the actions of local government, and I won't go into that, but I mean, the disparity is very real in terms of what you can purchase in a regional setting versus what you can in Sydney. Yeah, and that therein lies the point around employment. We are seeing, interestingly for me, two of my constituents also happen to be the heads of the Department of Education and the heads of the Office of Environment and Heritage in New South Wales, yet they live in the far south coast. So we are seeing telecommuting become increasingly apparent, and at the same time people are doing a lot more commuting.
Michael Bone, then we go down the back and over there.
Michael Bone. The two examples you gave of need for reform in terms of duplication were health and education. And there's no doubt from your talk that the accumulation of power, if you like, in Canberra has been at the disadvantage of the states, which underlines the need for reform. But there's a respectable view that the High Court, in fact, has been the greatest factor in the concentration of power in Canberra. What's your strategy for advising the High Court that there is such a thing as a federation?
I think some of the High Court's interpretations have obviously not worked out well for the states. But there's also a number of conventions which I think in a modern advancing society, particularly in terms of the advent of technology, must be changed. So, I think certainly in terms of the fact that we don't have some of those core responsibilities of the states enshrined in our constitution presents a fundamental problem, a major fundamental problem. The reason I identified the National Disability Insurance Scheme is there is a wonderful example of the two tiers of government doing something outside of the box. I think to that end, this is the type of thing that must be examined in the context of the federation reform. Obviously, constitutional change is a very difficult process, but look, ultimately, I think we can achieve far greater outcomes through some of our conventions and changing those conventions to deliver the outcomes.
Question out the back.
Thank you. Treasurer John Schroeder from Stockland. This whole conversation about supply of residential and things like that, and you look around Sydney and the degree of obsolescence that's emerging in quite a few suburbs. You mentioned a couple already. Up where I live, Gordon's clearly obsolete. The prior leadership of the New South Wales state puts a wonderful planning regime in place for Gordon to enable considerable regentrification and considerable residential density to be created, linking into the rail station. All very logical, but as a developer, it is impossible to consolidate the land. It's impossible. So there's many parts of New South Wales where it's impossible to consolidate the land. So my question to you is, to what extent do you believe that the leadership of this state will begin to introduce condemnation, eminent domain, compulsory acquisition, there's various terms, to facilitate the consolidation of the land to enable the development to take place, and therefore helping correct the supply imbalance?
So I think everyone got it, but just for the podcast, the suggestion that certain suburbs are, was the term, antiquated or obsolete?
Obsolete.
And what might the government do to help developers consolidate the land for development?
I think one of the greatest disappointments that we as a government have had in our first term is related to the decision of the upper house to depose our planning reforms. That was incredibly costly. I think also one of the, and I'm going to be careful what I say here, you know, Sydney has too many local government areas as well. Yeah, 41 is too many. So we have incentivised local government with a $1 billion package to start to bring them to the table. Prue Goward is now looking at ways in which we can reform, particularly through e-planning, to meet some of those challenges. And one of the core responsibilities of Urban Growth New South Wales is start to deal with the very issues you speak of in terms of fragmented land and all those very other obvious challenges around trying to marry everything together. I think we will see even greater leadership as we've seen the transformation from Landcom to Urban Growth to start to achieve that. I'm very excited about that initiative. Only in the last 48 hours we've brought together some of the leading world experts to have a look very closely at the Bays precinct in terms of what can happen there. I look at the fact that we are investing in that the Sydney Light Rail project out to Randwick. Well, you know, what potential uplift can flow from that? We've got work that's being looked at in terms of the North Parramatta precinct. So the opportunities are there. Having to take on the risk in the current planning environment is the issue that I think most people are grappling with. And we need to bed this down. And we have a minister who at the moment is working with her department. I recently joked in a forum that the government needs to commence airstrikes against the planning department. That was an uncharitable way of saying we must reform the system. It is very much top of mind, top of agenda for the planning minister, for the premier, and the state treasurer. I'm seeing firsthand the direct economic consequences of us not getting this right. I want to see the jobs growth, I want to see the economic prosperity and wealth generation and the confidence in the people of this city to thrive. And it's held us back for too long. Bob Carr should not have put up the closed sign. It was the wrong decision.
We're getting very close to the end. There's a question here.
Thank you, Treasurer. Energy is a key factor in the development of this state as well as the country. How can you ensure that there are downward pressures on the cost of electricity for this state in particular? When you go out to the country, the people there are really feeling it apart from this city.
The question is, how can you ensure downward pressure on electricity prices, not only in Sydney, but particularly in the country?
First of all, these are inefficient businesses. Without the private sector discipline that's required, we have seen some terrible decisions over the years. I mean, we are talking about a regulated asset. This mismanagement over the years, from everything from the union rorts, which are running amok right across the network in terms of some of the practices, through to the very obvious decisions in terms of dealing with the capital inputs, have led to a very ugly situation for households and businesses over the last 5 years. An average 60% increase in household bills. There's no doubt, based on the experience, and particularly in Victoria, that private sector discipline does deliver fantastic outcomes. If you consider that between 1996 and 2012, the network cost component of electricity bills in Victoria declined by 18%, yet over the same period in New South Wales, they increased by 122%. 122%. Therein lies one of the major arguments for reform of this sector. I mean, we enjoy the upside benefit of recycling the capital into more productive infrastructure. At the same time, you know, we are talking about a lease, not a sale. We bring forward future expected income streams, obviously factored in the retention value to make sure that we aren't losing value for the taxpayer. And then, of course, by having that management in the networks that we must see, and we have worked hard to try and achieve this in 4 years through Networks New South Wales and Vince Graham, but it's not where we ultimately want to see it. I'm expecting over the course of the next few months a very aggressive ETU campaign. But coming
electrical trade union
campaign against this. For them, it's all about their closed shop. From a country perspective, you know, I'm very conscious that we do pay higher prices in the bush, but I don't accept some of the these practices. I don't think it's right that an essential energy worker can take a company car to go fishing in the Northern Territory for 3 months with petrol card in hand whilst pensioners in the bush are struggling to put food on their plate because they're too busy trying to pay their electricity bills. If I look at some of the practices, particularly around depots and the like, it's outrageous. So, you know, we're about to enter a number of enterprise bargaining agreements with the unions as we move through this transaction. We have given an indication of jobs guarantees and at the same time given a guarantee in terms of price reductions around the network costs, because we know that by just simply having that private sector management in place, that you can start to drive efficiencies through these businesses, and governments should get out of the way. You know, it's not something we should be doing. We don't have the skill set, and we just certainly aren't delivering the outcomes in terms of the efficient operations of these businesses. So I'm very excited about this reform. I think it's a game changer for the state. And it's one which is going to be hotly debated in the next couple of months.
Treasurer, many thanks. There are more questions, but we've had over 35 minutes of questions, and all good things must come to an end. And I thought it was a nice way to end, looking into the future and into the immediate and medium-term future. Many thanks to Andrew Constance for coming along tonight. Without question, the economic performance of New South Wales in recent years has been quite outstanding, and I guess a lot of people are responsible for that, but one of them has been speaking to us here tonight. The Minister gave us a good idea of his overview of the current economic situation in New South Wales in the context of Federation reform, what he'd like to see in the future. And then he took close to 40 minutes of questions and covered all manner of issues. So we're very grateful for you coming along tonight. No doubt we'll have you back in the future, but for tonight, thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.